Charles Darwin was the son of two generations of English country physicians. He was from a wealthy family. He was born a naturalist, he said. When he was a little kid, he loved poking under rocks and looking for fossils and birds' nests and making collections. His father thought he was going to grow up to be a bum, bring disgrace on the whole family, and so he shipped him off to medical school when he was 16 to be a doctor like the rest of his family, but he couldn't stand the sight of blood, so that killed that. So then his father said, well, why don't you be a clergyman? Then you can collect beetles and save souls at the same time. So he was studying at Cambridge to be a churchman. I mean, Darwin started out as a creationist. He started out as a member of the church. But he could not get rid of this love he had for nature and trying to understand the birds and the beasts. And so when an offer came through one of his professors to be the ship's naturalist on a surveying ship, HMS Beagle, that was going to do a 5-year voyage around the world, he begged his father and he got permission to go. And he said, that was the start of my real life. That was the start of my real education.
So he sailed on the Beagle, which skirted around the coast of South America, among other places in its journey over 5 years, starting in 1831. And was there someplace along the line a eureka moment for Charles Darwin?
Yeah, he had a eureka moment, but it had nothing to do with evolution. His first eureka moment came with his first scientific book, which most people don't know about. It's called The Structure and Distribution of Coral Reefs. And the question was, how did these islands with little lovely lagoons in them get built out of this white stone in the middle of the ocean? Nobody knew. And Charles Darwin figured it out. He had a theory that the seafloor was sinking in certain places and that these corals lived on the edges of underwater volcanoes, and as they continued to sink, the critters kept growing up towards the light very, very slowly. It took millions of years for these reefs to form. And that was his first scientific publication, The Theory of Coral Reefs. The evolution stuff came much later when he was back in England. Contrary to the popular myth, he missed the whole lesson of the finches and the Galapagos tortoises and didn't realize until about 1837, after he was home, started to try to figure out what he called the laws of life and became an evolutionist.
I want to go back to the voyage, but it did take him a long time, more than 20 years later, 1859, when he finally published on The Origin of Species. What took him so long?
Well, he procrastinated, yes. First of all, he thought he was going to do a much bigger book. He was much too cautious. In fact, the original title for Origin of Species was An Abstract of an Essay on the Origin of Species. He never finished the big book because a younger naturalist, 14 years his junior, called Alfred Russel Wallace, working alone in the jungles of Malaysia, came up with exactly the same theory of natural selection and sent it to Darwin by post. It reached him and threw him into a tremendous panic. He had a moment where he said, oh, let him be first. I'd rather burn my whole book than to anybody think that I stole anything from Wallace.
Well, what was it that he saw during his voyage on the Beagle that firmed up for him the concept of natural selection?
Well, Darwin, first of all, he was a collector on that ship. He collected thousands of specimens of rocks, fossils, insects, birds, anything that moved, he shot. That's what biologists used to do. They used to kill everything in studying life. And He brought up enough specimens back home to keep several experts at the British Museum busy for years, writing them up and describing them, discovered thousands of new species. And he started to see patterns. He said he wasn't interested in just collecting anymore. He wanted to do a philosophical kind of naturalism, natural history. He wanted to find patterns. And he saw patterns. He saw patterns of what happens during a volcano in Chile, an earthquake, how the coasts get lifted up and the seafloors sink. He excavated some giant sloth fossils in Patagonia and some Glyptodon, which is a giant extinct armadillo. And he realized, well, there are armadillos down there today, the little small ones, and there are sloths there today, little small ones. But what's the connection between the ancient large prehistoric animals and the modern ones? They must be related. He began to get the idea that all of life is related, and this is probably even more important than the idea of natural selection. The great tree of life, because in Darwin's day, it was believed that, you know, every plant and animal was sort of zap, you're created. That's what still people believe. Some people believe that today, that creation is instantaneous and different life forms are not related to one another. But Darwin saw that we're all netted together. All living things are our cousins. And that's the foundation of evolutionary biology, with or without natural selection.
Well, it's a pretty radical concept. How were Darwin and his book received in his lifetime after the publication of Origin of Species?
Well, at the beginning, there was a great outcry. And, of course, there were some very famous moments. Bishop's wife is said to have remarked, "Descended from the apes, my dear, let us hope that it's not true. But if it is, let us hope that it does not become generally known to the public."
I think we're getting a little bit of the reformer on the other side of the interview table here. I've read that your show is based somewhat on Darwin's letters, and he was an incredibly voluminous letter writer. What do we learn from his correspondence?
Well, the correspondence is an amazing thing, not only for Darwin, but for anybody. There were 14,000 letters that have been found to and from Darwin. And they constitute a very valuable record, not only of Victorian science, but of our culture, because Darwin was in touch with so many people, all the great thinkers and writers of his day. And we have this wonderful window into his world. And there's in England, the Charles Darwin Correspondence Project has cataloged and edited and publishing all those letters. And they have many of them online now, thousands of them. And you can just go online and read Darwin's mail.
So let's fast forward to the 21st century, and Darwin's ideas have certainly remained good science, but by performing as Darwin, you must get a sense of how he resonates with the people of our world.
Well, many people find that I've humanized him in a way that takes him away from being the stodgy old bearded icon. Because for me, there are many Darwins. You know, everybody has to find their own Darwin. He is so large, you can find yourself in him. There's the young boy turning over rocks and collecting birds' nests. There's a student trying to find a career, never losing his boyhood love of nature. He's an explorer. He's a field collector. He climbed mountains. He rode horseback. He was an abolitionist who hated slavery. He talked to animals. He did geology, botany. He was a philosopher. He was a father of 10 children. He battled fraudulent psychics and spiritualists. He part-time worked as a magistrate in the neighborhood, keeping order as a judge. He was a semi-invalid, but he was indefatigable, turned out hundreds of papers, books. Remarkably large man, large mind, large life.
Is there anybody in contemporary society or contemporary science who might fill a similar role in our society?
No, I don't think there is. But on the other hand, I don't think it's possible for anybody today, because science has become so specialized, to know everything the way Darwin did. I mean, he was probably one of the last men who knew everything. Well, he didn't. He didn't know physics and mathematics. But in those days, I mean, there was less to know. But he often said, "I am a millionaire in odd and useless facts." No, I don't know anybody today. I mean, the last great genius that we had, and it was Albert Einstein. I mean, there are some bright guys out there, you know. There's E.O. Wilson, and there was my late lamented friend Stephen Jay Gould, and these are all extraordinary people, extraordinary gifted and energetic. But a Darwin or a Wallace or an Einstein is another thing.
What was it for you that led you to bring Darwin to the stage? And was it Darwin the person, the science, and why music?
Well, I've always loved musical theater. And, you know, I don't like to do things other people are doing. If somebody is just doing straight scholarship, that's fine, and writing certain kinds of books. But why would I want to write something that anybody else can do? Or why would I want to write a musical of the kind that anybody else can do? I want to do things that nobody else can do. That's what each of us wants to do, is express themselves in a unique way. It happens that I wrote the song "Why Didn't I Think of That" as a joke when I was in anthropology grad school at University of California, Berkeley, during the early Paleolithic. I imagined Rex Harrison in the part of the egotistical, flamboyant Thomas Huxley. Of course, I couldn't get Rex Harrison, so I had to perform it myself in self-defense. The most recently added song in my show, Darwin's Nightmare, written with my friend John Worham a couple of years ago, represents a work stretching over a lifetime.
And I particularly enjoyed I'm the Guy Who Found Natural Selection, done in the style of Jimmy Durante. And I'm not sure there are many people out there anymore who remember Jimmy Durante.
Isn't that sad, too? Yeah. I'm afraid some of the people in my show, most of my audience, they have to be of a certain age to get some of the jokes, because I do Maurice Chevalier, who's long gone, and Jimmy Durante. But I don't know. These are people whose styles are known. They're in movies. And well, listen, frankly, I don't care. I like them. I enjoy them. And I figure if I'm having a good time, the audience will have a good time.
In person. Stop the music. I want to reminisce. One day, I'm walking through the rainforest with Alfred Russel Wallace, brushing aside an orangutan or two, and we sees these papillary butterflies, thousands of them. Al says to me, "Jimmy, look at those butterflies. Why, they're papillating all over the place." I said, "Indubitably, Alfred, they're selecting their mates. It's only natural." He said, "Jimmy, that's it. Natural selection."
And before we let you go, you've got a new book coming out this year.
Yes, at last. It's something I've been working on for a long time, probably 15 years. It's Darwin's Universe, Evolution from A to Z. And it's an update and revision of an earlier book I did called The Encyclopedia of Evolution. And it not only covers Darwin and his descendants and his ideas and his voyage and everything else, but it's the whole story of this great cultural enterprise where we are trying, thousands of people have made contributions towards, trying to find out what kind of critter we are and where we came from.
Looking forward to seeing that, and also having the chance at some point, hopefully, to see you as Charles Darwin live and in concert.
Thank you, and may your life and your listeners' lives, like Charles Darwin's, be one great long voyage of discovery.
Richard Milner in New York, thank you very much.